The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
If you are passionate about food and how it supports well-being and health, learn more. The Institute for Optimum Nutrition has been training nutritional therapists for 35 years on its highly acclaimed and accredited diploma courses. Start your new career in nutritional therapy, one that will make a difference and help others achieve their health goals. Train with the home of nutritional therapy education. Find us online and give us a call or click on the IOM banner on the UK Health Radio homepage.
Hello, welcome to the Yes to Life show, UK Health Radio's weekly show about integrative medicine for cancer. I'm Robin Daly, regular host for the show and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, which helps people with cancer to find out about their many options within integrative medicine. My guest on the show today is a powerhouse of a woman. She's a doctor who's had cancer herself. She's a visionary thinker about health, and she's someone who whips up a bit of a storm wherever she goes. Dr. Nasha Winters has been on the Yes to Life show before to introduce her book, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer, and I'm delighted to be able to talk to her again today over Skype at her home on the west coast of the US. Really great to get the chance to talk to you again. I had hoped to have a bit more of a chat when I saw you recently at Truefield a month or so back, but you were besieged by fans most of the time, so I didn't even try, and I thought we could get in and have a little interview now.
Perfect timing, I tell you. When sometimes these last minute moments are the perfect little gifts for us.
Anyway, your presentation at Truefields was extremely popular, I've got to say. I mean, your message goes down really well with people there. What do you think it is about your particular message to people overall, which is kind of hitting the spot so well?
Oh, I think that's a good question. You know, the feedback I personally get is that, number one, as a clinician, I'm actually, you know, on one side of being sort of the person who helps folks with this, but the other side is I've walked this path and continue to walk this path as a unwilling participant of the cancer process.
Yes.
But I think the other side of it, what sort of delivers well, is that I don't see it as a deficit or something negative. I see it as a teacher and as something that really has inspired my path and passion in this world, and hopefully touches people in a way that shows us that we're all capable of healing on all levels.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're certainly passionate about it all. That comes across every time I've seen you or talked to you. It's amazing how much energy you have for this territory, which is, of course, fantastic. It's so needed.
Thank you.
Okay, so lots of things we could talk about today, but I'd like to pick up on two things that you mentioned in your presentation at Truefields, two things that caught my attention. The first was you mentioned a mistletoe trial that's currently in progress at Johns Hopkins. Now, I had Dr. Michael Evans, a UK anthroposophical doctor, as my guest a couple of weeks back on the show, and he told me that mistletoe is the most commonly used cancer treatment of any type in Germany. Quite an extraordinary statistic. Can you tell me about the trial, which I believe you mentioned because of its importance?
I sure can. And first of all, I want to second what Dr. Evans said. I mean, mistletoe, if you have a cancer diagnosis and you live in Germany, Switzerland, France, or Austria, you have an 85% chance of utilizing that therapy at some point during your cancer process.
Wow.
The rest of Europe, it's about a 60 to 65% of the time. So it is widely used there. Another quick side note, it is now part of the repertoire of the healthcare system in India. And the second highest population of anthroposophical medicine is actually in South America. And there's even entire hospitals in like São Paulo, for instance, has a pediatric oncology unit which utilizes mistletoe as a concurrent supportive therapy in their pediatric oncology patients. So it has a huge world presence and reputation. It's been around for 100 years. I'm assuming you and Dr. Evans spoke to some of those highlighted points, but ironically, where I live in the United States, unless it has been done there in a double-blind placebo study, then it basically doesn't hold any water, which is ridiculous because there are over 2,500 clinical trials worldwide over dozens of years, yeah. And 250 of those would be considered high quality, you know, double-blind placeboed RCTs that the U.S. would normally get their paws around. In fact, we had a trial back in the 90s that started, but it unfortunately lost its funding. So this trial that's currently happening at Hopkins was basically philanthropically funded. It's outside of the sort of industry funded process. And it began in February 2017. The trial went into effect, which is for folks who've had a stage 4 solid tumor diagnosis that have had one failed response to standard of care. And so the caveat is that you have to live in the area because it is a intravenous dose escalating therapy that's done twice a week in Baltimore, Maryland. So it does limit its participants to have to be local.
Right.
But an interesting caveat to this is the original trial was based on a woman's story, a woman by the name of Evie Lise Page, that had a terminal diagnosis of colorectal cancer 12 years ago. And her, when they went in there, she has a strong family history of something called Lynch syndrome. Lynch syndrome is a very aggressive genetic hiccup, if you will. Her father, her lots of aunts, uncles, grandparents succumbed to colorectal cancer from this genetic variant that creates a very aggressive cancer that also is not very responsive to conventional standard of care interventions.
Nasty.
So when she was, so when she was diagnosed, they went in to do, you know, she'd had her colon, she was doing all of her due diligence, doing her colonoscopies, and everything looked good until 6 months before it was a clear scope. And the next thing you know, she's got symptoms and they decide to do exploratory surgery. And as they got in there, they realized it was everywhere. Especially in her liver. And at that point, she and her family decided that outside of a surgical intervention to debulk the tumor burden as much as possible, she was not going to take on a standard of care approach, as she didn't want to spend the last few months of her life as she watched her father and other family members succumb to the cancer treatment itself. She opted to sort of go out with some quality of life. But she, you know, listened to some people who made the recommendation of utilizing mistletoe, something she'd never heard of. And speaking to her team, her medical team at Johns Hopkins, at that time, Dr. Luis Diaz, probably one of the best known oncologists of gastric cancer at that time, agreed to basically monitor her and still do all the due diligence follow-up because he did know she didn't have a good chance. And I think started out sort of humoring her, if you will, and then ended up deciding that, you know, as he monitored her over the years, he kept saying, well, I guess we can start to have some hope in all of this. He's now the head of solid tumor oncology at Sloan Kettering. So this is a man who holds a lot of respect in the conventional oncology world.
Yeah.
But what Evie Lee started to do was subcutaneous injections several times a week of mistletoe following her surgery, her debulking surgery, which was non-optimal, meaning there was still tumor residue left. And that was 12 years ago. She's not had a recurrence. She's thriving. And she and her husband started an organization called Believe Big. I give you this background because it's that believebig.org organization who, under the supportive watch and guise of initially Dr. Luis Diaz, who then, when he transferred to Sloan Kettering, the primary investigator took over. Her name is Dr. Channing Paller, also a brilliant and well-respected oncologist at Hopkins. That clinical trial, they raised the funds to start a phase 1 clinical trial. Right. And for your listeners, if they're not familiar with phase one, two, and three, a phase one trial is basically a safety trial. Like, will this drug outright kill you? That's right. Phase one. A phase two is what dose is tolerable? How high of a dose can we take that's tolerable? And a phase three trial is that's when we only then start looking at survival outcomes and whether or not this makes a difference in progression or survival. Mm. And so I always tell patients, unless they're willing to give their body away to science before they're done, I would not really suggest a stage one or two clinical trial because you're kind of a guinea pig to see what dose, you know, will or won't kill you. But something like mistletoe is a little less concerning in that because there actually are plenty of studies worldwide showing its safety and efficacy, even at extremely high doses. So when the Hopkins team decided to start the trial, they were initially only going to do subcutaneous injections for pancreatic stage four inoperable cancer.
Right.
That was where the trial was going to start. But we all happened to meet up at a big international conference in Germany in the fall of 2014. And when the Hopkins team started to hear the researchers and clinicians from all over the world sharing their results and their experience, and they caught wind of the fact that I had been using mistletoe in the United States for many, many years and was implementing intravenous applications, that's when they started to pay attention. And a few months after that gathering, I was contacted directly by Dr. Luis Diaz. And he basically said, we've been watching you, bum, 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 and you haven't killed anyone yet. And so we're interested in going back to the drawing board and creating a whole new IRB, which is basically a peer-reviewed safety and efficacy and ethics committee review of the trial, and they decided to opt for an intravenous all solid tumor approach. And I'm really thankful they did because that really pushes us further along and
yes.
getting this as a much more utilized therapy in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, a trial with just pancreatic cancer late stage patients. I mean, if you can demonstrate any benefit, of course, that's pretty fantastic. But still, it takes so much to translate it to other cancers, doesn't it, in terms of, you know, anybody believing that it's any use, however good it is with pancreatic cancer.
Exactly. And, you know, Robin, I'm glad you brought that up because I attended an international integrative oncology conference last fall. And one of the researchers got up and expressed the fact that it takes an average of 17 years mm-hmm. for good clinical trials to reach the public, to actually reach our medical system. And if you're dealing with something like pancreatic cancer or stage four cancer of any kind, you don't have 17 years to wait for somebody to come up with that data.
No, that's right. And so hence why, you know, the fact that we have, well, particularly in the UK, we have this complete absence of kind of any even intelligent experimenting, if you want to call it that, is just simply outlawed by the computer system. You know, you just have to do what it says on the computer, even though everybody knows it doesn't work. And so clinicians have their hands completely tied and they're not allowed to, you know, use their training, their experience in order to say, well, we might be able to improve it if we add a bit of this. We know it's safe, so why not? They're literally, they can't do that stuff. And it's absolutely maddening.
It is. It is. And, you know, this is why groups and gatherings like True Fields Festival and other organizations and events like it are what are changing medicine.
Right.
Because even I've been out there saying these things for over 25 years and colleagues of mine doing this, you know, even longer, mm-hmm. We don't make a difference, right? Even if we are showing good evidence, clearly we don't make a difference. If we totally decide to put our blinders on to 2,500 clinical studies on this very topic, we know that we aren't going to make a dent. But what does make a dent is when patients start to scooch their dollars elsewhere.
Right.
So when patients start to say, you know, I'm not going to purchase your $100,000 chemotherapy regimen. I'm going to purchase this $150 to $300 US dollars a month regimen and see where that takes me first.
Mm-hmm.
And that starts to make a dent in their multi-billion dollar industry. Now, one thing I want to say about this is that I am not against standard of care. I just think it's done really really aggressively and really rough and with a lot of guessing, when we're at a time when we can be very precise and even delicate, if not even elegant, about our approach, and we can start with really understanding the entire patient, all aspects of their being, before we choose the right approach of their care. And it can be done so in a very integrative, bridged, and supportive way. Mistletoe has been used for 100 years consecutively as an injectable, as an adjunct to chemo, radiation, targeted therapies, hormone blocking therapies. It has never been promoted as a standalone treatment for cancer, though myself and many of my colleagues around the world will tell you we have seen some pretty interesting outcomes that suggest it can be, but we always like to use it in a layered effect because cancer is multi, you know, dimensional, and tumors have heterogeneity, meaning they have multiple layers and multiple personalities within them. And so using a variety of tools simultaneously is going to give you your best outcomes.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, the other thing about the change in the trial that you're doing, which is interesting, is you moved from these subcutaneous injections to intravenous. And that, in mistletoe terms, in the, you know, for a 100-year-old treatment, is actually very recent, actually, that development, isn't it? And it is producing some quite surprising results, I hear.
Yeah, and I love that you brought that up. We started introducing the intravenous applications about 30, 35 years ago in very small, kind of like those N equal one experiments, you know? And what has happened since is there are multiple clinical trials now on intravenous application. We're finding that sort of the IV mechanism of action slightly differs from the subcutaneous. And Dr. Michael Evans might have also mentioned that there's also been in the last few decades an increasing use of intratumoral injections of mistletoe, as well as intraperitoneal and intrapleural, meaning into like an abdomen that's filled with ascites fluid, malignant fluid, or in the pleural cavity in the lung space that's filled with fluid. And so there's actually several clinical trials that have shown that intrapleural or intraperitoneal injections can actually dry up that fluid. And create an anti-angiogenic and anti-inflammatory effect, and that's pretty profound. And then in the intratumoral, in fact, one of the things I think that compelled the Hopkins team was when they saw the research of the group, I can't remember where they're out of, somewhere in Europe, that were showing real-time video of people injecting pancreatic tumors with mistletoe and showing real time the necrosis and breakdown of those tumors on these unbelievable, you know, 3D imaging scans that were showing real time movement of natural killer cells and whatnot. And I think those guys kind of felt like, oh, geez, like that, we're not quite ready to go to intratumoral, but certainly people are far more advanced than doing a subcutaneous treatment for this, a late stage, very aggressive cancer. So I think it got them thinking that they need to go back to the drawing board. But we have colleagues who do inject. I've had personally about 12 patients who've sought anthroposophical physicians who did intravesicular, meaning into the bladder, injections in the clinical office, like not in a hospital, but in a physician who feels comfortable doing so and was properly trained, doing intrabladder injections of mistletoe for bladder cancer with 100% resolution. I've seen that well over a dozen times now. I even had one doctor from MD Anderson who saw my patient for surgery after she had done some subcutaneous mistletoe and three injections into her bladder of mistletoe. She went in to have her surgery because she was basically doing these things to get her ready for the surgery with the anticipation that she was going to have her bladder removed and a new bladder constructed from other body parts. When he went in there with the cystoscopy, the scope that looks inside the bladder, he was able to take in basically a little spatula, and literally he said that tumors that had previously embedded into and through the bladder wall peeled off, like those little things you throw against the window that stick and then slide off. He said it just slid right off. He was astonished. And since then, this medical doctor has seen a handful of other patients and had similar responses to this. He scratches his head. He is very conventionally trained, and he has seen it with his own eyes and is very supportive of patients using mistletoe, subcutaneous, IV, intratumoral, intravesicular, et cetera.
Mm. Well, extraordinary. Amazing stories you told there. There have got to be some listeners who's going to be hopping up and down hearing this.
I hope so.
Yeah, I love that thing you're saying about the ascites, because, of course, you know, I know lots of people who've had terrible trouble, including my own daughter, with ascites, and they, you know, they just drain it off, and then, you know, a short while, it's all back again, isn't it? They don't really have anything to offer except some horrendous operation where they throw in a load of powder in there to try and soak it up or something. You know, to have something that actually works in a natural way to clear something like that up is amazing.
Yes, agreed.
Mm. Well, look, so much you've talked about already, and my head's spinning. It was a real piece of synchronicity there, because you right at the beginning of the interview, you were talking about what goes on in South America. And how anthroposophical medicine's a big hit down there. And funnily enough, where am I going in a week or so's time? Sao Paulo. Who am I going to see? The guy who you talked about, who runs the children's unit.
Ricardo!
The pediatric unit. So,
oh my gosh.
Yes, I'm seeing
him a big hug for me. I love that man.
Anyway, I'm seeing a couple of guys down there, and they'll be on the show, of course, in a couple of weeks' time. So, very interesting. I seem to be on a kind of a bit of a streak of anthroposophy at the moment. I'm not sure why, but it's all interesting to me. So, very good. Let's keep going.
Well, really quick before we go further, next year, September 2020, marks the 100-year anniversary of anthroposophical medicine. There'll be several big events in Switzerland and Germany. So you might talk to Dr. Michael Evans about that. And I'm sure people like Ricardo Gelman from San Paulo will be in attendance, as will I. Yeah. And it's also every 2 years in Germany at the Helixor campus, which is one of the companies that manufactures mistletoe. They host a conference every 2 years, the IMM, International Medicine Meeting, and I will be there presenting as well, and you will meet physicians. Many of them are anthroposophical physicians from all over the world who utilize mistletoe in a variety of ways in their clinical practices and clinical trials, and even huge university medical systems throughout the world.
Mm. Well, it's beginning to sound like mistletoe might be about to get its moment in a big way. I mean, it's taken 100 years, of course, but nonetheless.
But the reason being is thanks to all of our passion and focus and research dollars funneled into immune therapies. And yet we have one that's very inexpensive and shown to have good outcomes without the side effects. And I think it's finally getting its rightful place at the table.
Yeah. So it's a time of immense progress in understanding all sorts of areas of the science around cancer, and new resources from all fields, but, you know, very much so in the world of integrative medicine, are coming up all the time. Within all that, of course, mistletoe is a bit of a senior citizen, you know, 100 years old. How do you rank it as a resource for cancer patients in amongst everything that's out there? You know, how does it compare, do you think, with some of the other things that you can do with a cancer?
That is such a good question. I mean, first of all, when I look at something that has such a long history of safety and efficacy, I look at something that is able to be employed at home on yourself. Right. I look at the cost point in comparison to other quote-unquote alternative therapies or even standard of care therapies. And I look at the way it can, from an anthroposophical perspective, what a lot of the anthroposophs believe is that cancer itself is the ultimate disconnect and loss of rhythm within the being. Mm-hmm. And what mistletoe has been shown over and over is sort of reconnects the communication and the what we call the three R's of the immune system, which is to first recognize something's going wrong, number two, respond, and number three, remember. when we have a cancering right. process, typically one, if not all three of those R's are not working properly.
Right.
Mistletoe
right.
restores that communication. And then it also helps reset the rhythm, the natural rhythm within the body and being. And also where research is moving now, we believe that it upregulates things like the endocannabinoid system and the endorphin system, mm-hmm. hence why it's been reported for 100 years to have a huge impact on the quality of life. These are three biggies when you ask a cancer patient what they're looking for. Yes. You know, those are kind of the top three. So it would definitely rank up in kind of my top three wow. treatment approaches for wow. folks anywhere along their cancer journey.
Well, that's quite an accolade. Interesting. So you talked to one of the three R's you mentioned there was this rhythm thing. And this was something, we used mistletoe with my daughter. And of course, it was subcutaneous then. But this seemed to be very much about establishing rhythm. Is that right? That that's the way of treatment that over a long period of time that can bring that back to balance.
It sure is. And when you just think about our world today, we're all sort of living in such a fabricated environment,
yes.
you know, yes. and, you know, I mean, you have to remember, I think what 2017 or 18 was the Nobel Prize went to circadian rhythm, mm. right? And this is definitely an area where we're realizing we are all out of sync with nature, seasons, our light exposures, our feeding schedules, our work and life balance schedules. We're kind of just really out of rhythm across the board. And we're bringing little people into this world and putting them in front of screens from the get-go. And our classrooms are becoming quote-unquote smart classrooms where we're surrounded by EMFs and things that definitely disrupt the circuitry in our circadian rhythm. And we're, you know, sleeping with the lights on and we're working grave shifts. I mean, all these things are throwing us off. And our circadian rhythm is incredibly ingrained in our focus and our mitochondria. Mitochondria and how they function optimally, and in our antioxidant levels related to our melatonin, which is a major hormone of our immune system, a natural antioxidant, as well as sort of the master conductor of our circadian rhythm. And it's intimately related to our light and dark schedule and exposures. So when you talk about that, yeah, we're all way out of rhythm. And when I look at the population of the patients I see today, they're sicker and sicker, starting younger and younger. And when you look at, you know, like, I still want to use my paper calendar versus my phone,
yeah.
you know, I'm definitely in that transition in my late 40s compared to those 20 years my junior and those 20 years my senior. I kind of straddle that line of both worlds, and yet everyone kind of coming out of the womb right now comes out with the Bluetooth, you know. It's like it's
connected.
yeah
it's very interesting. You're right, there's so many, it's such a rapid development of on so many fronts at the moment, all of which are kind of untested in a certain kind of way. They're all experimental, really, because we don't know what happens to human beings over a long period subjected to any of these. You know, it's an extraordinary experiment that we're kind of cooking people in a soup of all sorts of exposure and then finding out what the result is, which if cancer is any measure of what the result is, well, it's not good.
You got it. And, you know, it's funny that you say that there's no real study. That actually is starting to happen all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the first ever sort of scientific symposium on the effects of, you know, blue light exposure and EMFs is actually taking place I think 7th, 8th, and 9th of September in Santa Cruz, California.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge EMF conference. I think if you just Google EMF conference, Santa Cruz, California, September 2019, you'll pull that up to look at the list of researchers from all over the world. Go and then look at what their data is, what their studies, what their trials are showing. And you start to realize that we are already well aware of the harmful effects of this. And yet the industry, sounds familiar, right? Been here before.
Heard that
is
before.
Pushing things through because of the almighty dollar.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, just to wrap up on the mistletoe trial, one last thing. I mean, there's an aspect of this trial, which is obviously because it's a bit of a first in the US, and the US is less embracing of mistletoe than Europe, for example. Obviously, it's going to bring some credibility if the trial results are as good as you hope, that it's going to help bring credibility to mistletoe in the US. But it's a particular approach that you're making now with the intravenous. Is it going to bring other data to the table that doesn't already exist?
That's such a good question. And, you know, this Believe Big organization that started with one woman and her N=1 experiment,
yes,
that is now literally out there helping fund, like, their organization helps people in the United States get grants, wellness grants to see integrative, you know, practitioners, helps them get wellness grants to afford their mistletoe therapy. Unfortunately, it's just related to those in the United States.
Right.
But, you know, that their vision is in the future to hopefully make this a global availability. But ultimately, what it's doing is, as their name implies, that concept of Believe Big, it's leading them down other avenues of interest. And when I was invited to be a keynote speaker at their annual fundraising dinner that helps continue to fund this trial and these wellness grants, my story and my experience with mistletoe prompted them to invite me to be just an advisory person on their board, you know, a non-paid position, just there to kind of bounce ideas and thoughts and you know, concepts off of. And I'm also an ongoing kind of clinical advisor for the clinical trial because I've had, you know, at this point, 15, 16 years of direct experience with this medicine, and thousands of patients that I get to reference back to. But that being said, is what they started to recognize is, like, the more you learn, the more you look, and the more you learn, and the more you look, and the more you learn. It just keeps us moving forward. And what we realize is there's never one cause nor one treatment for a cancer process. And we have, because of our biochemical individuality, because of our epigenetics, because of our tissue types and our molecular markers, because of our environments in which we live, and that's on all levels from mental, emotional, spiritual, down to the physiologic, you know, anatomical, to the exposures we have today. You know, you and I've talked previously in the past about what goes into sort of our mitochondrial bucket, things like epigenetics, glycemic control, hormones, inflammation, immune function, blood circulation and oxygenation, stress response. Those are the things that we have to assess in every patient. And where we're moving in the data world and in the medical world today is in a systems thinking model.
Right.
So the people who are making the biggest changes in medicine outside of patients demanding something different,
right,
are people in the engineering and the biotechnology world. It's not happening within the clinical environment because we're limited or we're being funneled into a particular way of thinking and a very reductionistic way of thinking in our medical systems. And yet people like engineers and, you know, the self-professed biohackers and the biotech companies, they see a problem and they have to come up with solutions. And they do so by looking at all the data, collecting all the data, analyzing all the data, and creating sort of artificial intelligence around it. And I hate that word artificial. To me, it seems like it's more like informed data. You know, it's a collection of information that gets to be analyzed. And this is where medicine is going. And one of the things we need to do is we need to look at all the different parameters that impact somebody's outcomes. And when you try to do these clinical trials of a one target with one treatment, right, we will never see a shift in the cancer outcomes. In fact, on August 1st of this month, if you go and take a look at Scientific American kind of biology updates, they have a really great article about basically how cancer therapy isn't working.
Right.
It just isn't. No matter how much BS we give it in the marketing world, it isn't. And it's really well done in how they describe it. And it's because the model in which we study and fund the studies is so broken and so polluted and so, you know, it's just, it's insane to me that they're recognizing we have to change the way. And so part of that change in the United States is this is a vision I've had since my diagnosis almost 28 years ago. I started having dreams about this place. And this place was an in-house residential hospital in which all of the best therapies, be it from standard of care to the best vetted and studied integrative therapies from all over the world, are done in a systems model and data collection environment within a research-centered hospital setting. That was has been coming together in my vision. I've been drawing and putting it together. I've been exploring which states. I've even looked at which countries for many years and realized that the only way we're going to really make a difference is if we start in the U.S. because mm-hmm. we're the people who are further behind in cancer than anybody else in the world. So if we're going to really make a difference, let's go to the bottom of the barrel and work up. And looking at all of the states out there, I had to look at what has the widest scope of practice, which has the least expensive, square footage for building such a facility. On myself, in tens of thousands of patients, and the fact that I get to travel all over the world to go to different conferences and meet different clinicians, hospitals, and research institutions around the world, I get to have that bird's eye view perspective of the strengths and weaknesses that are out there. Okay. And each time it's like I put another feather in the hat of what this could be to really change healthcare as we know it. Mm. And luckily for me, the types of people I keep meeting are people who have very similar visions. They have a different lane of it than I do. I have a very clinical bedside version of this, and I have a general vision of what the physical space looks like. But then I have the people who have the administrative aspect or the financial brilliance or the clinical research brilliance or the genomics brilliance that can come in and feed out this process. So we've all come together, and we are actively working now on getting the funding together to build this very first in-house residential integrative cancer research facility hospital that is also going to be a university. People will come from all over the world to learn. Right. And it's going to be on a huge acreage where we all, it's off the grid. All the food, all the water, everything is grown there. Everything is basically taking us back to where we were before we started flubbing things up in the post-industrial revolution right. of things. Every little piece is being considered. When we talked about the rhythm and the pattern, you know, those things earlier, we are trying to create a health model that helps people's bodies remember the rhythm in which we were all naturally, you know, where we all naturally came from. Right. And that environment is just as critical as the therapies and the testing we do around it. So that is a dream that we believe will be up and running within probably 3 years. That's our goal at this point. Okay. And it's in motion as we speak.
That's incredible. Well, that is a very big project. A magnificent one though. So what you're saying about the way that it's going to operate is going to allow, in a way, for the enormous complexities of the huge number of variables that exist both in patients and in treatments with cancer, and will assimilate that complexity of data and work with it. Is that right?
100% right, Robin. And our goal is to make this place the pilot and then to have satellites all over the world. So it's not, even though it might birth initially from the soil in the U.S., it will inform oncology and generally general healthcare as we know it, especially in the prevention realm, which is key around the world, because cancer is expected to double in rates by 2030 worldwide. That is unforgivable. I can't even fathom that. And so I'm on a mission, as well as folks like you and folks like Sophie True and folks like, Sophie Savage. And I mean, all these folks, we are out there screaming at the top of our voices saying there is so much more that can be done. Mm. There is so much more that needs to be explored than what's being offered.
Okay. And can I just put the UK down as number two on your list after you've sorted out America? Will you just knock us up a centre here, please, of the same kind?
Agree. And it's people like you, finding your little, anthroposophical tribe and coming to True Fields, me meeting a whole group of amazing physicians in the UK, from Dr. Ariana to Dr. Indaba, to others that are out there really creating a ripple. All of these little ripples are going to come together under one roof.
Amazing.
To make a difference, because it is the Jane McClellans of the world. It is the Patricia Daly's of the world. It is all of these folks contributing their medicine to make a big shift and a big ripple in the whole system.
You're absolutely right. If we actually were able to combine all these forces, all of this knowledge, all these resources, The amount we could do to change the status quo, I think, is extraordinary, and clearly you do as well.
Agreed.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that amazing. What a story. So people can take a look at the Believe Big website and see what the plans look like. You know what your vision is there. Correct?
Definitely. If you go to believebig.org, mm-hmm. you can take a look at the clinical trial information as well.
Okay.
But you can also look, I believe under resources, it says it's the Believe Big Institute of Health. It's kind of our working title at this point in time because they're sort of housing our place for communication as we're pulling this all together. But it is, like you said, a big undertaking. But we're finding that there are so many people really willing and passionate about contributing to changing this daunting paradigm that we're currently in to bring something hopeful for future generations.
Fantastic. Well, look, you left us on a high there. I think I'm going to wrap it up at this point. Amazing. Thank you so much for that. It's just so great to hear that kind of initiative. As you say, it's a desperate situation already. Slated to get much worse if we carry on the same way. The whole system that's trying to theoretically sort it out is completely broken and is part of the problem. So we definitely need something completely different if we're going to actually do something about it. So it sounds like that's what you're attempting there, and I'm impressed.
Thank you. It takes all of us. So any ideas or thoughts you have, please, you, anyone who's listening to this, if you have your own vision, we are collecting this data, this information. You'd be surprised at how many working parts there are, but every voice we want to have heard and contribute to a definite different outcome for folks in the future.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you so much, Naysha. Really exciting talk. Thank you.
All the best.
Well, I did mention that Naysha is a bit of a force to be reckoned with. I hope you found that inspiring. She's certainly enough to give you hope for a far better future for cancer care. I mentioned at the outset her valuable book, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer, which is a great resource for those with cancer, so do look it up. And if you get the opportunity to hear Naysha speak in person, do take it. If you want to read more about her incredible plans for a research hospital, then go to believebig.org/BBIH. Thanks for listening today. I look forward to introducing you to another fascinating guest from the world of integrative medicine for cancer next week. Goodbye.